The headlines: a massive crowd of Palestinians pray at the Al-Aqsa Mosque and a show of unity against Israel ahead of International Quds Day. Moscow warns the West of a tough military response to any further attacks on the Russian territory, accusing the U.S. and its European allies of inciting Ukraine to hit Russia. And teachers and train drivers in Sri Lanka join mass walkouts demanding President Gotabaya Rajapaksa to quit over the country's worst financial crisis in decades. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. We begin this hour with the developments about Palestine, where just a day ahead of the International Quds Day, tens of thousands of Palestinians have converged on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound for congressional prayer. Palestinian media have put the number of participants at 250,000 who gathered in a show of unity amid the recent Israeli desecrations of the holy site. Following the prayers, the worshippers chanted slogans against Israel and condemned the regime for its violent crackdowns at Al-Aqsa Mosque. The gathering was held despite Israeli warnings. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says the recent developments in the occupied Palestinian territories indicate that Israeli's days are numbered. The IRGC censored in a statement Arab states that have normalized ties with the Israeli regime. It said such actions are aimed at fading the issue of Palestine into oblivion. However, the statement said the recent developments in Al-Quds and Tel Aviv vindicate the fact that normalization will not bring security for Israel. The IRGC did not mention any specific events, but in recent months, Israel has seen a number of unprecedented armed operations across occupied territories, including in Tel Aviv. The statement said the occupied territories are about to see a massive burst, and at the same time, Israel's demise is gaining speed. The IRGC reiterated that resistance is the only way into the liberation of Palestine. The NATO Secretary General says Finland and Sweden will be able to join the Western military alliance quickly if they ask for membership.
We are in dialogue with Finland and Sweden, and it's their decision. But if they decide to apply, Finland and Sweden will be warmly welcomed and expect the process to go quickly.
Jan Stoltenberg has told reporters in Brussels that he is sure arrangements could be found for the interim period between an application by the two Scandinavian countries and the formal ratification in the parliaments of all 30 NATO members. Russia is strongly opposed to Finland and Sweden becoming NATO members and has threatened to deploy nuclear weapons and hypersonic missiles in its Baltic enclave of Kaliningrad if that happens. NATO's eastward expansion was one of the main reasons driving Russia towards launching an offensive against Ukraine 3 months ago. Russia once again warns the West against pouring weapons into Ukraine. The Kremlin says supplying Kyiv with heavy weaponry will eventually destabilize Europe.
The tendency itself to pump weapons, including heavy weapons, to Ukraine and other countries is an action that threatens the security of the continent and provokes instability.
Peskov's comments come a day after British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss said the UK and other Western states should give Ukraine tanks and warplanes, among other heavy weapons. The Downing Street, however, says for the time being, dispatching fighter jets to Ukraine is not on Britain's agenda, but it has not ruled out training Ukrainian pilots or sending British aircraft to Eastern Europe. Western countries have so far sent hundreds of millions of dollars worth of lethal weapons to Ukraine amid its war with Russia. The UK Undersecretary of State for the Armed Forces has said it is acceptable for Ukraine to use Western arms against military targets in the Russian territory. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Tensions between Moscow and the West over Ukraine are growing to a fever pitch. Russia has warned the Western countries against pushing Ukraine into attacking the Russian territory. The Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman said the U.S. and its key European allies are openly encouraging Kyiv to attack Russia. Maria Zakharova said a tough military response would be awaiting any further offensives against the Russian soil. This after Moscow reported a series of attacks by Ukrainian forces on the Russian bordering regions in recent days. Zakharova also labeled the Ukrainian president a, quote, puppet used by the U.S. to threaten Russia. The spokeswoman's comment echoed a similar remark previously made by President Vladimir Putin. John Stepling is an author and commentator who joins us from Inderøy, Norway. And George Samueli, senior research fellow at the Global Policy Institute, joins us from Budapest. Welcome to you both. John Stepling, let me first start with you. One of the most striking statements that came out of the Secretary of Defense of the U.S. was when he said, we will move heaven and earth to make sure that Ukraine is armed in order to defeat Russia. More and more, we're seeing how the U.S. is not really even talking about the humanitarian aspect of this war, but the military aspect. What do you think of the statements there by Lloyd Austin?
Well, they're not surprising. I mean, the U.S. is not interested in peace. They are squashing any attempts at peace negotiations. They are inflaming the conflict. But this is part of a plan by the U.S. and NATO, which is a sort of U.S. proxy, going back all the way to probably the late 90s, certainly to the Orange Revolution and then into the coup in 2014 that the U.S. orchestrated. You can look at the U.S. Fomenting this dismantling of the former Yugoslavia. That was a kind of trial balloon for the expansion of NATO. The U.S. had given its word, James Baker, George Bush the first, given their word to the Russians that there would be no eastward expansion of NATO. And they lied, and they began expanding eastward almost immediately. There's an economic element to this as well. The U.S. is looking to ultimately, orchestrate some kind of coup d'etat in Moscow, replace Putin with somebody that, and break up the country, I guess, into, you know, this is Victoria Nuland and the people at the Rand Corporation and all of these think tanks. The IMF is instrumental in these kinds of projects. And when they chased the Russian-friendly president out, Yanukovych, and replaced him with Poroshenko and the people that came after Poroshenko, now Zelensky, the IMF was very happy because these are guys that are interested in welcoming Western capital in, implementing the reforms that Victoria Nuland described as so essential, like cutting wages and subsidies for gas and so forth. And countries that have refused that, Bolivia and Yemen, for example, suffered coup d'etats as well. So the U.S. doesn't care that this Ukrainian right-wing regime is heavily infected with neo-Nazis. They're not even neo, just Nazis. Fascists, Hitler-loving, racist, and swastika-wearing. They don't care. These are people that are helping them with this grand plan, in their minds, of regime change in Moscow. You have to remember, the U.S. interfered in Yeltsin's election in 96 in Russia. They interfered directly in the coup in 2014 in Ukraine. They have been shipping billions of dollars of weapons to Ukraine since 2014, and probably before that. They have sent U.S. military in to train Ukrainian soldiers, including the Azov Battalion and the right sector, the far right nationalist fascists. They've been doing this for years, and the truth is there are U.S. soldiers on the ground in Ukraine right now. It's a de facto war already. Ukraine is being treated as a de facto member of NATO already. So, of course, Russia is going to respond. And just as a final thought, the people of Donbass think Putin stopped a war. He didn't start one. They had been shelled by the Kiev regime for 7 years, to the tune of 14,000 civilian deaths. So this is all stuff that is simply not reported in Western media at all.
Well, George Samueli, Russia has said that, it's testing its patience And it has said that on repeated occasions, that the threat of World War III breaking out is very real. I think we're looking at World War III based on what John Stepling is saying. If you got U.S. forces there on the ground, you have the U.K. encouraging countries to actually attack positions inside or target positions inside Russia. Isn't that a kind of World War III?
Well, I think so, and I think we're obviously heading toward an open military conflict between Russia and NATO. I don't think it can be avoided now. I mean, a few months ago, we might have, a month or so ago, we might have said, well, cooler heads will prevail, there'll be sensible ways to de-escalate, but it's not happening, and Russia keeps issuing these warnings, and the NATO countries are just simply escalating their involvement in Ukraine. Russia can't now back down. I think Russia has now issued very, very clear red lines. It's obvious that the next step, that they're going to start hitting military command and control centers in Kiev. And what the Russians have said, and what Zakharov has said, was that we know that there are clearly NATO advisors in those command and control centers, and that they are likely to get killed during these Russian strikes. So that would be the next step. The step after that, and I think that's now also unavoidable, is that Russia will start hitting targets outside of Ukraine. So in other words, they're going to start hitting Polish railway hubs, Polish railway stations, all of the places in which Poland is being used in order to dispatch arms into Ukraine. Now, what happens then? NATO will, of course, try to say, okay, that's it. Russia has now attacked a NATO member state. Article 5 must go into operation, and all for one, one for all 30 members must now consider themselves at war with Russia. I don't think that's going to fly, and that may be the point at which finally Western public opinion will wake up, for the very obvious reason that Article 5 doesn't apply. And it doesn't apply because NATO has violated Article 1 of the North Atlantic Treaty. Article 1 explicitly states that every NATO member state is obligated to resolve any conflicts it may be involved in exclusively by peaceful means. By getting involved in Ukraine, a non-NATO member state, by fighting against Russia, a non-NATO member state, we know that NATO is a co-belligerent in Ukraine. It's a co-belligerent. You know, they can't go on pretending that they're somehow not involved in this. They're directly involved, and therefore Article 1 has been violated by NATO, and therefore Article 5 doesn't apply. And I think at that moment, let's hope the Western public opinion will wake up and say, no, NATO has really violated the very treaty that brought it into existence.
What's incredible, John Stepling, is the fact that the U.S. is leading the NATO members, the European countries, into the point of view that, you know, if you don't act and provide, for example, arms to Ukraine or act against Russia, that you could be next. And it seems like these countries are falling for that. But yet Russia doesn't have any sort of intentions of that nature, does it?
No, of course not. And I think we have to look at the role that Western media has played, the propaganda, the massive, just stunning amount of propaganda that is bombarding the populace of the West 24/7. Out, just amazing levels of Russophobia, anti-Putin stuff. This has gone on for years, of course. I mean, part of the reflexive reaction, part of the reason this propaganda has been so successful recently in the West is that the people have been subjected to this bombardment for a decade. This anti-Putin stuff is in Hollywood movies. It's on, you know, MSNBC. Russians are accused of interfering in U.S. elections when it's the opposite. But all of this propaganda has been going on for years, so you get the feeling when you listen to the leaders of NATO countries and the EU that they hate Putin to such a degree, that he is the new Hitler, and there is this kind of outsized irrational hatred of Putin and Russia among the leadership of the EU, that they fear this or hate it more than they fear and hate the idea of nuclear war. You would think that the avoidance of a nuclear conflagration would wake people up, have them sit back and say, wait, we can't keep escalating this, we can't keep inflaming the rhetoric and pushing the limits of what Russia is going to find acceptable. And Russia's been very patient over, since 2014, certainly. You wouldn't know any of the background, though, if you just listen to Western media. It's absolutely, right. Absolutely shocking, really.
And with that, we come to an end for this news review. Of Sri Lankan trade unions protest during a nationwide strike, demanding President Gotabaya Rajapaksa's resignation over the worsening economic crisis. Many schools in the capital, Colombo, were shut and several train stations deserted on Thursday as teachers and train drivers joined mass demonstrations. Hundreds of employees of Sri Lankan state-run banks also united with other workers in a protest march on the presidential office. The trade union leaders have threatened an ongoing strike as of the 6th of May if the president and his government do not resign. The country has been witnessing the protests for weeks now. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, said, "Palestine is now the scene of humble bravery by an innocent generation and nation."
The city of Al-Quds, the jewel of the Islamic world. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. On the threshold of the World Quds Day, the Zionist regime has escalated its crimes against Palestinian nation on the one hand and is making efforts to further normalize ties with gullible Arab regimes. All these measures are aimed at casting the cause of Palestine into oblivion. This has been the Israeli policy for the past decades. The fake regime claims to make peace and come to reconciliation with Palestine and Arab governments while it continues aggression and brutal suppression of innocent civilians. It seems it is only the Zionist regime which can practice such a deceptive policy. This much of brazenness has its roots in the all-out support of the US and European governments who shamelessly claim to defend human rights, democracy, and freedom. As a matter of fact, the Western regimes have been been the vassals and stooges of Israel for several decades, to the extent that no party or person can take power in these countries, especially the U.S., unless they fully pursue the Israeli interest. The victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979 was an earthquake, and it changed the situation of Zionists in the occupied territories. A new factor entered the equations of West Asia, namely formation of the axis of resistance against the axis of compromise and servility. The victory of the Islamic Revolution as the greatest event of the 20th century helped shape the first units of resistance in Palestine. The group was called Palestine Islamic Jihad Movement, which was shaped by martyr Fatih Shaghaghi. Shaghaghi writes in his book that Imam Khomeini's revolution is the only way to encounter Israel. He makes it clear that the movement had been formed in Palestine under the impact of Imam Khomeini's uprising. Palestine Islamic Jihad Movement drew the attention of most Islamic currents, and they supported it. 8 years later, the first intifada was born out of the Islamic resistance groups. The intifada was called the Intifada of a Stone. Simultaneously, the second Islamic resistance movement was shaped, comprising young members living in Palestine. The intifada, which had started in 1987, continued for 6 years. This forced Zionists to propose negotiation with Palestine Liberation Organization and the credulous head of the organization, Yasser Arafat. However, the efforts of Israel for talks with Palestinians go back to one decade before, after the Al-Karama battle in Jordan and coming to power of armed Palestinian groups and the incident at Munich Olympics in 1972, Zionists tried to create relations with Palestinians. The channels of relations were created by leftist currents in Israel and some Palestinians who were advocates of the West as they lived in Europe. Zionists in 1982, in order to put Palestinian liberating groups in bottleneck, occupied Beirut and expelled Palestinians from there. Although Zionists continued to occupy South Lebanon for almost 2 decades, it set the ground for negotiations with Palestinians. The Intifada of a Stone in 1987 dictated the logic to Israel that they should expect more clashes if they didn't move toward talks. On November 15, 1988, Arafat announced the independence of Palestine. The move appeared to be revolutionary and brave, yet it was indeed a blatant retreat from armed struggles that had started 3 decades earlier. The declaration was announced less than 1 year after the first intifada. The Palestinian people had lost many martyrs during the period, and Zionists were under serious pressure. The treacherous Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak told Arafat that he was dealing with his blood as he strongly supported the previously signed Camp David Pact. The Madrid conference was held in October 1991 with the support of the US and then USSR. The conference was held with the aim of reviewing and, if possible, exterminating the Intifada, which was in the fourth year of existence. The Madrid conference was among the first global efforts towards the so-called Middle East peace process. The fabricated Zionist regime, PLO, Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan were present at the conference. This conference was the last conference which was held with the simultaneous aegis of Washington and Moscow as the Soviet Union collapsed in the same year. The The Madrid conference ended after 3 days with no tangible fruit. Within 2 years that the supplementary sessions of the conference were held in Washington, no result was attained either. However, while the conference was underway in Madrid, a Palestinian team headed by Abu Mazen was clandestinely negotiating with Zionists in Oslo, Norway. The Oslo talks were intensively kept hush-hush by Europeans till they ended. PLO failed to materialize its demands, and finally, under the European pressure, the organization capitulated to a weak agreement as the precursor of complementary agreements. The Oslo agreement had no fruit, but recognition of the fabricated illegitimate regime Israel by PLO. On the other side, Zionists didn't recognize Palestine as a country, but they just recognized PLO as the official representative of the Palestinians inhabiting on the West Bank of River Jordan. According to the agreement signed in 1993 by Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat in Washington, Zionists agreed to give parts of Palestine to PLO. According to the agreement in 1994, it was decided to give the Gaza Strip and a tiny part of Jericho to PLO. It was also agreed that the region was temporarily given to Arafat, and during the negotiations, which should not take more than 5 years, the final agreement was supposed to be concluded by the two sides.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagin.
The topic that we're trying to discuss related to tomorrow, Yawmul Quds, which is the day that all people that understand the conditions and they are human enough to understand that they need to support, come, of course, led by Muslimin. They're the Muslimin are the ones, the Muslim leadership, the Islamic leadership designed this, ordered it, commanded Muslimin, and the Muslimin have been coming out for all these years, but there have been others that have joined as well. While that armed movement is necessary, here's the question. The question is, how will the Zionist regime come down? How will Israel be wiped off the map? How will that happen? There seems to be different views regarding this. And of course, I'm not sure how much people actually spend time thinking about that. It is something to think about. How are we going to bring down the Zionist regime? What is our what's our strategy? What are we supposed to be doing? Is what's happening in Gaza, is what happened and is happening in Lebanon, in Syria, the part that is related to Israel, the armed movements and the defense mechanism and the defense system systems set up in those areas. And hopefully we will see that in the West Bank as well. Are these ways that the Zionist regime is going to be dismantled, is going to be wiped off of the map? Is it going to be some missile that Iran is going to launch from somewhere within its borders, or Syria is going to launch, or Iran is going to launch from within Syrian borders, as they say, because the Islamic Republic works with people. They don't go into somebody's house and say, we're going to do this, forget you, and so on and so forth. Yes, of course, if the Americans use a different country like they did in Iraq to shoot down and to assassinate believers, Iranian and Iraqi, then they have they are in their full rights. They're not going to coordinate that with anybody. You killed the believers there in Iraq. Now the American base in Iraq is going to be attacked, and we're not going to make arrangements with anyone or seek permission from anyone. But to do something within the borders of a country with their presence, with the presence of the Iranians, and do something that those governments don't want, no, that's not their policy. The people of every country decide what happens in their country, and they work together. It's a collaboration. It's not like the relationship of the Americans in Iraq. They go into Iraq. The Iraqi people didn't want Haj Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis to be assassinated. The Iraqi people didn't want Haj Qasim to be assassinated. The Iraqi people didn't want the Americans to do any of the things that they wanted. But the Americans don't make any arrangements with the Iraqi government or with anyone in Iraq. They just go do whatever they want. That's not how the Islamic Republic is with these areas. Anyway, is it going to be some Syrian missile, some Hezbollah missile? And Hezbollah, again, is also doing things based on what they see, right? The Islamic Republic supports them, supplies them, and so on and so forth. But they make decisions based on what they see, right? Are they going to be shooting some missiles? Is Hamas or Jihad al-Islami going to start launching missiles against the government establishments in Tel Aviv, in Haifa, and wherever else they may be? Is that how the Israeli government and Israeli regime is going to be wiped off of the map? Is it how the Westerners say that what they mean by wiping it off the map is to the way they think? Because this is how the Americans do it. They say, we're going to wipe off Hiroshima off the map. And what do? They nuked it. That's how they do it. When they want to wipe a place off the map, their version is bombs. The mother of all bombs. They dropped it in Afghanistan. All these bombs, they're in love with bombs. Destruction. Wipe it off. That's what they mean when they say wipe it off. Is that how it is? Do we think that these organizations with their arms and their defense mechanisms are going to be dismantling the Israeli regime? Some may be thinking that way. The way Imam Khomeini has told us this regime will be wiped off the map is not through those means. Although those means are necessary for defending the people who need defending in those areas that were mentioned. But for the Israeli regime to be wiped off the face of the earth, Imam Khomeini's strategy from the day he announced Yawm al-Quds is a people's movement marching every year until it will be possible that they march, no missile, no bomb, no guns. Of course, again, at that point, the Israelis and the Americans, their backers, will try to use force. Hezbollah, Hamas, Jihad al-Islami, perhaps other movements, Ansarullah, the Yemenis people, they will all be prepared to defend the people that will be marching. And they will not allow a massacre of those people who are marching into Palestinian cities that have other names that the Zionist regime has put on them. The people will march and they will dismantle it without destroying anything except for the symbols of Zionism, the symbols of Kufr. Besides that, everything will remain and it will all be about construction. This is a strategy, brothers, sisters. This is a different way of dealing with things. Let me use the example of the Islamic Republic. There were those who believed that we need to fight the system militarily with arms. And they did take up arms against the regime in Iran, the Shah's regime. They took up arms. They smuggled guns in, they smuggled bombs in, and they tried to use them against the regime. Not that the regime doesn't deserve this, that's another point. Not that Israel doesn't deserve it. anyone in Israel, and that includes a lot of, unfortunately, people in Israel, have been part of this occupation, have been part of the killing of innocent people. So not that they don't deserve to be treated in that way, but what is our way of dealing with these systems, these governments? With the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini's strategy, based on what he understood from Quran and Hadith, is while there need to be people who defend the innocent, but the way you're going to be taking down the system is by popular movement. People need to come out on the streets and say that this system should be no more. When a global march is launched against the Israeli regime and it marches, breaks down those walls, goes into their parliament, their centers of government, and demand that whoever is not originally Palestinian must leave, and here are the jets, get out of here. And there is no such government any longer. It's all gone. When that happens, nobody can get in the way. No nuke can stop people flooding the streets of Haifa and other cities in Palestine that are under Israeli rule, unfortunately. This march on Quds Day, going out in numbers, whatever numbers we can afford. We can't say, oh, there isn't enough, we're not going to go. No, whatever the numbers are, it's a global effort. When you add every 5, 10, 20, 100, 200 or more in whatever city, whatever location to the numbers that are global, it keeps on adding to the figure. But that is the strategy of Islam, that's the strategy of the leadership, that popular march, people marching every year annually, will lead to a march that will actually walk into Palestine. And inshallah, we will see that. We will see that. Look at the march on the Day of Quds in this way and understand how much more important it is than what you ever thought it was. This isn't simply just going out there, creating awareness. All those things are going to happen. It is giving awareness to people. It is showing a face to the Zionists. But it's building up more than anything. This is the strategy of the Islamic global movement to wipe the Zionists off the map. And inshallah, it will happen. It has taken quite some time. And it will take some more time. But this is how it's going to happen. Arms need to be there for defense. But the way that these governments are going to be taken down is by the demand of their own people.
Every day we tell each other that this day will be the last, and tomorrow we all can go home free, and all this will finally end. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Oh. Precious grain of sand, every stone and every tree, 'cause no matter what they do, they can never hurt you, 'cause your soul will always be free.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality, youth, Eastern Tales, Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. In Britain, the flagship public health body set up by Prime Minister Boris Johnson to combat the pandemic is in turmoil, with plans looming to cut jobs by up to 40% and suspend routine COVID testing in hospitals and in care homes to save money. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalists Rowena Mason, Heather Stewart and Dennis Campbell. The piece is titled UK Health Agency to Cut 800 Jobs and Halt Routine COVID Testing. In Britain, the flagship public health body set up by Boris Johnson to combat the pandemic is in turmoil, with plans looming to cut jobs by up to 40% and suspend routine COVID testing in hospitals and in care homes to save money. White House sources have told The Guardian that the UK Health Security Agency, UKHSA, led by Dr. Jenny Harris, is in a state of disarray, with morale at rock bottom and concerns it is not funded to cope with the resurgence in the pandemic. Public health experts warned that the alarming cuts could cost lives. More than 800 staff are due to be lost from vital health protection teams across the country in the coming months, a reduction of up to 40% from the current 2,000 members of staff. One insider said people were being given 2 weeks' notice that their contracts were being ended early, and the way it was being dealt with was similar to the recent situation at P&O. Some other teams throughout the organisation have also been told they need to cut full-time equivalent staff by 40%. After the Treasury slashed its budget to deal with COVID, the UK Health Security Agency, UKHSA, is now proposing to health ministers that it suspend regular asymptomatic testing in hospitals and care homes from May to save money before a potential winter spike in cases. Sources in the organisation said funding for asymptomatic testing in high-risk settings is only enough to cover 6 months of the year, and senior officials believe it would be better saved for later in the year. The proposals come after the government heavily scaled back its provision of free testing for the general public as part of its Living with COVID plan, with the previous year's budget of £15 billion cut by up to 90%. At the time, the government said asymptomatic testing would continue in high-risk settings while prevalence was still high. Public health experts warned that cuts to testing and health protection staff were irresponsible, short-sighted, and risked resurgence of COVID, especially among health and social care workers. COVID prevalence levels in England fell significantly to 1 in 17 people in the week ending 16th of April, compared with 1 in 14 in the previous week. However, officials say they still regard this level as high prevalence. Professor Maggie Ray, president of the Faculty of Public Health, which represents 4,000 public health professionals across Britain, said, "If the COVID-19 pandemic has taught us one thing, it is the importance of having a properly funded public health system that is able to prepare for and respond to threats to our health. Government has consistently underfunded public health services, which are there to protect and improve health for all. To not only fail to bolster the public health system, but to continue to cut it so deeply is irresponsible and threatens the health of all in society, particularly the most vulnerable." Dr. Jyotna Vohra, Director of Policy and Public Affairs at the Royal Society for Public Health, said, "It is deeply concerning to hear about cuts to the UK Health Security Agency, UK HSA workforce, when we are still in a pandemic. Strong, consistent health protection messaging and activities are vital at this time. To remove free asymptomatic testing from health and social care workers feels irresponsible. With high exposure to the virus and to our elderly and most vulnerable members of our population, the health and social care workforce must have the greatest possible confidence in their infection status. Asymptomatic testing provides this. At a time when infection rates are still high, this feels like we're saving pennies at the cost of pounds, or worse, at the cost of lives." The Labour Party has also criticised the proposals to strip away more testing from NHS staff. The Shadow Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, said, "While the NHS is in a permanent state of crisis and patients are waiting longer than ever for care, the government can't seriously be considering stripping away support even further. Patients need to know that they will be safe when they go into hospital and care homes. These proposals risk leaving the NHS unprotected and unprepared." Staff at the UK Health Security Agency, UK HSA, told The Guardian that job cuts and the reduction in funding for public health measures have left an exhausted and demoralised rump of permanent staff at the organisation. One source said many remaining employees were in a state of ever-increasing anger and despair at the organisation's leadership and approach to its staff and strategy. Many are also angry over a debacle affecting about 300 UK HSA staff who were told they were wrongly being paid a £3,700 London waiting and that this would be removed. The organisation is now in discussions with its unions over the episode. The job cuts are a mixture of ending fixed-term contracts and redeploying or giving notice to civil service payroll staff. Many people are jumping ship, said a third source, with some senior policy staff at the director's level told in pairs that only one or neither of them would be able to keep their jobs. UK HSA was launched with great fanfare by Matt Hancock, the former health secretary, in 2021, bringing together the former Public Health England, its successor, the National Institute of Health Protection, and the National Health Service Test and Trace. Prime Minister Boris Johnson had ordered the new body after losing faith with Public Health England's handling of the pandemic during the first national lockdown in Britain. Asked about the plan to scale back testing further, UK HSA pointed to the Living with COVID plan and said any decisions would be taken by ministers. A Department of Health and Social Care source said UK HSA submission had not been received yet, but it would be looked at in the context of the plan. Meanwhile, Doctors in Britain who share misleading information on social media could face regulatory action, according to Plan New guidelines. Posts made on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok are among those that could be scrutinised by the General Medical Council, the GMC, if a doctor is reported. The General Medical Council is to update its Good Medical Practice Guide, seen by some as a modern-day Hippocratic Oath, for the first time in almost a decade. The latest draft says that doctors must be honest and trustworthy, make clear the limits of their knowledge, and make reasonable checks to make sure that any information given is not misleading. It is the first proposed update to the guidance since 2013 and is being put out for consultation. The document will also make it a doctor's duty to act if they become aware of workplace bullying as well as discrimination and sexual harassment.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic. Another region of arrogance is the achievement that one makes. You may achieve something and make progress in something that you do. Here you may become arrogant at what you have achieved. Another origin of arrogance is becoming confident about God's grace and attention. This has been mentioned in many prayers and even in the Quran. Nor let the chief deceiver deceive you about God. Chapter 31, verse 33. You must take care not to let arrogance, which is Satan, make you overconfident about God. What does this mean? It means that we may become sure of God's help and stop being careful and pious. For example, we may say to ourselves, we are among the friends of Ahlul Bayt. Therefore, God will not punish us in any way. This is overconfidence about God's assistance. And the most miserable misery is for him who is overconfident about you. This is in Sahifat al-Sajjadiyah. I think it is supplication 46, which is the supplication for Friday. Dear God, he who becomes overconfident about you is the most miserable person. This is overconfidence and arrogance. You must not become arrogant. If arrogance shows up, this will be a sign of defeat and decline. If arrogance shows up from either of these origins, it will be a prelude to one's decline.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
When one becomes arrogant, they will decline from the inside and in society. The social movements that have been formed around them will be ruined as well. There is a holy ayah or verse which says, "Assuredly, God help you in many battlefields and on the day of Hunayn. Behold, your great numbers elated you, but they availed you not. The land, for all that is wide, constrained you, and you turned back in retreat." Chapter 9, verse 25. The Battle of Hunayn was the first battle that the Holy Prophet had after the conquest of Mecca. There were a large number of people with the Holy Prophet, unlike the Battle of Badr, in which Muslims were only 313 in number. Several thousand new Muslims, emigrant Muslims and Ansar, went to Ta'if to engage in the Battle of Hunayn. After they had conquered Mecca, when they looked at their own numbers, they became arrogant. God the Exalted broke them because of becoming arrogant. The land, for all that it was wide, constrained you. The land, despite its vastness, became tight on them. And you turned back in retreat.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.